the silver screen to the GM screen, Never Say Die asks, what can we learn from movies to enhance our tabletop role-playing game experience? This season, we are getting the band back together with heist films, where a mastermind hatches an elaborate, usually non-violent plan to get a MacGuffin from a difficult location with the help of two or more specialists. Now, the plan may include one or more cons, hacks, or burglaries, but is rarely exclusive to just one of these. And traditionally, the audience is rooting for the heist crew.
I'm Rafe Telsch, film critic.
And I'm Drew Meyer, gaming enthusiast.
And today we're talking 2016's Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, the first of what was intended to be an anthology series of individual movies set in the Star Wars universe. The screenplay was written by Chris Weitz and Tony Gilroy, based on a story by John Knoll and Gary Whitta, and was directed by Gareth Edwards, starring Felicity Jones, Diego Luna, Alan Tudyk, Donnie Yen, Wen Zhang, Ben Mendelsohn, and Forrest Whitaker, among others. This conversation will contain spoilers, so you have been warned. But before we get to that, Drew, this is a podcast about movies and about role-playing games, so we like to talk about stuff that we've encountered lately or that we'd like to recommend to others. So do you have a movie you'd like to recommend to our audience?
I do. So, longtime listeners might remember that in 2023, I did a chronological Cronenberg watch. I watched every single one of Cronenberg's films, including the two student films, in chronological order. Get a good idea of the totality of that director's work, many of which I hadn't seen before. I am going to be doing this every single year. In fact, I'm probably
going to go to Cronenberg films every year.
Every single year. You never can have enough Cronenberg. Thank you for the correction. This year, I am doing not one, but two. But I will get to the second one when I actually start it. I have to finish the first one first. And the first one is Stanley Kubrick. Director who is, considered a master in cinema and only has 13 films, which is really great. However, more than half of those films are 3+ hours long, so it's really like
epics,
they've got 20-something.
Yes.
Yeah. I have so far gotten to the first 4 or 5, which are only 90 minutes, some of them even less. The first 3 are about an hour and a change. And the film I want to recommend is from 1957, and it is a perfect movie, one of the best films I've ever seen. I'm not going to say it's one of my favorite movies. I have to watch it 3 or 4 more times before I can say that. But it is mind-bogglingly good, and that is Paths of Glory, starring Kurt Douglas. This is a film about World War I, and that's all I'm going to mention. I went into it completely blind. I had no idea what it was going to be about. It was just the next film that I was going to watch. I'd heard good things, and halfway through it, I was thinking, if this film can stick the landing, this is going to be, a 10 out of 10. It stuck the landing, 10 out of 10. And then I read a review that explained the ending. You can still appreciate it not knowing this fact. I'm not going to explain what the fact is. But knowing the fact, 11 out of 10.
Wow.
Yeah. And again, I've only watched it the one time. It's only been a week or so. But I definitely want to go back and watch it. It's one of those films that were like, I should have been showed this in film school.
Right.
Was not. And yeah.
Yeah,
so,
it's
really
a,
good.
It's a gap in my film knowledge, I have to admit. That specific one has been recommended to me quite a few times, and I've never made the effort to see it yet. So I'll have to bump that up on my priority list since Drew recommends it too.
Yeah, well. So, Rafe, last time we talked, you had watched a lot of Oscar-nominated films. What was on the menu for you since in the last 2 weeks?
Yeah, well, and as I mentioned last time, I'd done the Oscar movie catch-up. I had done movies for a Hitchcock-themed class.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of cleansed my palate this last weekend with Ghostbusters Afterlife, which I had never watched. And I did this specifically because the trailer for Frozen Empire was enough to make me want to see it. I knew that they were going to pull some of the ideas from the animated series, which, by the way, showrunner for that for a little bit of time was J. Michael Straczynski. So I finally watched Afterlife, and I really enjoyed it. I mean, it's like nothing is ever going to touch the original Ghostbusters. And there's been a lot of really interesting discussions going on film threads about the fact that part of the problem is nobody can really identify the fact that everybody thinks it's a movie about busting ghosts that it happens to be a comedy, and they don't recognize that it's actually a slob comedy that then intertwines the busting ghosts into it. And I was like, that's an interesting theory, and that it would be why nobody gets it right anymore. But I thought Afterlife, as far as like a legacy sequel slash reboot, was really solid. I enjoyed it. Yeah, there's a couple of places where the visual effects could have been better, but there's also a lot of places where the visual effects were really good because they went back to basics and did practical effects. So, and I like McKenna Grace. I've enjoyed watching her in Big Bang Theory and a couple other things. And of course, I love Paul Rudd. So I think it's funny that it really is McKenna Grace's movie. And she's fourth billed on it. And kind of the same thing happens with Frozen Empire. She's the fourth billed on it. But it really is, the primary storyline is hers. Frozen Empire was good, not great. But I really enjoyed Ghostbusters Afterlife more than I expected to.
I still need to watch Frozen Empire. That is on my list of things to watch, particularly because of McKenna Grace, who I think is going to be one of the premier actresses. Everything that she has done that I have seen has been pretty much faultless. Yeah. And there's at least one movie. We have discussed a number of movies that I wanted to watch with you for your podcast. Most have been horror films, but there's one called Troop Zero that I think is one of the most beautiful films I've seen in the last 5 or 6 years. Not visually, but just like what it kind of means about it hits all the right buttons for an emotionally intelligent film. But more importantly, and this is kind of going along with what we talked about last episode, Rafe. Would you consider the first two-thirds of Ghostbusters Afterlife a Kids on Bikes movie, based off of the criteria that we selected in our first season?
Yes, I definitely would. I think before you get Paul Rudd directly involved, when he is more of a mentor figure, absolutely, that's a Kids on Bikes movie.
Yeah. Yeah, the third act still is very much a Kids on Bikes film, but then it gets overshadowed.
Right.
I'm not going to spoil it. You're not here for this one. But that was one of the first movies I selected to discuss when we first decided to do the podcast. I had seen it and said, okay, this is absolutely going to be one. And never got around to it. I mean, yeah. I kind of mentioned it in our discards. So again, if season 3 is Kids on Bikes, that is probably one that I am going to recommend. there's some good kid characters in it. There's really exceptionally good characters. There's also a couple of poorly painted ones, but there you go.
All right, Drew, what about role-playing games? Any role-playing game experiences you want to share briefly with the audience?
You know, I ran some games for some kids fairly recently. It was really good. I really enjoyed it. Rather than talk about something they did, I want to just briefly mention something I'm about to do. I got a buddy I've known from way back in the day, back in my Myrtle Beach days, Jim Toby Ryan, and he is a stupendous game master. Really enjoy his work, and he has invited me to play, not run, but play a game at the end of April called It Came from the Late, Late, Late Show. It's from 1993. It's a B-movie. You basically play characters in a B-movie.
Nice.
And I'm really excited. It's all designed to be one shots. We essentially create a 90-minute film in a 3-hour session. So I'm really looking forward to that because, as you know, I don't play very often. I am a forever GM, and I'm okay with that. That's the character that I'm most comfortable being in the role-playing games sessions and scenarios. But the idea of playing a character, creating a character, really excites me. How about you?
Nice. I'm going to cheat for mine, because I am also tend to be the forever GM, and I do miss playing. I have, for some odd reason, particularly in the last few weeks, I have missed playing. I had an opportunity for a game last weekend, but my schedule just didn't end up permitting it. So I'm on spring break as we record this. So I treated myself over the course of spring break to Baldur's Gate 3, is the closest you're ever going to get in video game form to being a Dungeons & Dragons player. It is ridiculous the amount of stuff that you can do that, like, video games shouldn't let you do. Some of the creative approaches to some of the problems and some of the ways that you can, like, it is so shades of gray in every aspect of the story, and you really do get to kind of paint what you decide is good or bad or indifferent or such. I'm having a blast. I'm only about 25 hours into it, which for a normal video game would sound like a lot, but I've heard from a lot of people who've put in 250, 300 hours on Baldur's Gate before they reach the end of the story because they're doing exactly what I am, which is trying to experience everything. And it is, it is so much fun. And I can't say anything, like, I have like three absolutely crazy stories about stuff that happened in the game that you would laugh at, but it would spoil potential story beats for other players. So I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Listen, the fact that you started Baldur's Gate 3 and you managed to pull yourself away from Baldur's Gate 3 to record this podcast speaks volume to your dedication to this podcast, I must say.
Yeah, it's been a week of a lot of playing.
Well, with all this game playing, have you gotten a chance to listen to any podcasts?
No, nothing really to talk about on the podcast front. I really need to do a better job of listening to new podcasts, but I just don't do it that often anymore.
Sure.
Just, I have the feeling with some other stuff that I have getting ready to happen, I probably will start listening to a few more.
Cool.
But usually I just go off your recommendations anyway. So what do you have to recommend?
I got two things. And I haven't got a chance to listen to it in its entirety, but today Cradle to the Grave dropped its best of 1988 episode part two. That is the top five horror movies of 1988. So of course The Blob is going to be on there.
Oh yeah.
I'm not going to say where it is on that, but not only is The Blob, but there's a Cronenberg film in there as well. So I'm very excited to listen to that. But more kind of, not I want to say more important, but the Blank Check podcast with Griffin and David, which they do, you know, entire oeuvres of directors, is doing John McTiernan.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, really good. I mean, like, they've got some amazing guests. Your old buddy Kevin Smith is in there. There's quite a few folks. So you're looking at McTiernan, you're looking at Predator, Die Hard, Hunt for Red October, Medicine Man. They just dropped Last Action Hero, a film that I love.
Yes,
I absolutely love it. Adore. You and I are kind of, well, I mean, we're very close to the same age. We're kind of cut for the same cloth. We're as far as meta humor goes, I think you and I both come to that same level of appreciation for it. We're Hudson Hawk fans, Last Action Hero fans. You know, they're both looking at the genre and kind of deconstructing it and then in mocking it in a way, but also then making a very successful version of it. So the Last Action Hero thing is very interesting. And the, you know, a couple of weeks from now, they're going to be doing The 13th Warrior, which is another one of my favorite films of all time. But
I
it is.
I have not seen that one.
I highly, highly recommend it for anybody. Just know going into it that it was an incredibly problematic film to make. It's considered one of the great flops, but it's also a really intelligent film. It shouldn't have failed in the way that it did. It's kind of bonkers that it did. Another film that McTiernan did that we probably will not be talking about on this podcast, but we could, is the Thomas Crown Affair, the Rene Russo one with, my brain just went Remington Steele. That's
Pierce
not
Brosnan.
His actual name, Pierce Brosnan, which is a really good fantastic heist film, which kind of qualifies, but not really.
Right. It doesn't have the number of assistants and the number of the crew.
It doesn't have the crew. Yeah. And so it really is kind of a one person con heist. So, you know, but again, absolutely worth that's one of those films that my wife and I will probably watch every 3 years. You know, be like, you know what I'm kind of in the mood for? Let's watch Thomas Crown. So yeah, both of those podcasts, definitely just good viewing. And if you like any of the films that McTiernan did, you know, yes, it's a comedy podcast, but it's also done by really well-spoken, very intelligent, very knowledgeable hosts and guests. So you're going to get something out of it regardless of how you approach film.
Nice.
Rafe, it is time to talk about this month's film. And in order to do so, you have to give me a simple plan. This is going to be, you know, in our first season, we did elevator pitches. This is going to be slightly more than elevator, unless it's a really slow elevator. So what is your simple plan for Rogue One, A Star Wars Story?
Well, my actual elevator plan was, hey, Drew, remember Star Wars? Remember how the MacGuffin at the heart of most of the movie were those Death Star plans? Well, how did they get their hands on those? That's where Rogue One comes into play. But that's just the elevator pitch.
It's a good elevator pitch.
Yeah.
You give me that pitch and I'll be like, yes.
All right, so to go into the simple version of the movie, a branch of the Rebel Alliance led by Captain Cassian Andor frees Jyn Erso from Imperial imprisonment. It turns out her father, Galen Erso, is one of the key architects behind the Death Star. Galen has sent a message about the station through an Imperial pilot who has defected to Galen friends Saw Gerrera, not knowing that Saw has become the leader of a militant group of rebels no longer associated with the Greater Alliance. The rebels need Jin's help to get the pilot and the message, which is mission number one. Upon rescuing the pilot, the team, which isn't assembled as much as just kind of falls together, they head to another planet to find Galen Erso, Jin specifically to rescue him, but Cassian with orders to kill him. That is mission number two. Cassian doesn't end up pulling the trigger, but Galen ends up dead anyway, causing the rebels to have to go to an Imperial data facility on Scarif to steal the Death Star plans and save the galaxy, which would be mission number three. While the team succeeds in stealing the plans and getting them to the Greater Rebel Alliance, it comes at the cost of the entire team's lives, which explains why these characters have never been heard of in the seven preceding movies.
I mean, that is absolutely the film. Shall I pitch you a simpler plan?
Sure, absolutely.
Now, of course, simpler plan means I'm gonna sum all that up in one line. And I'm gonna do this four times. Ready?
Yes.
Simpler plan number one. Finally, a movie all about Bothans.
There's no Bothans.
There are no Bothans. Of course, many Bothan spies died to get these plans.
That was for the Death Star 2.
Oh, is it?
Yes, that's from Return of the Jedi.
You're right. Oh my goodness, I'm a bad Star Wars fan.
It's all good.
It's okay. I've never claimed to be a good Star Wars fan.
Right.
Number two, and this is a more realistic plan. Sometimes when you need to get the plans, you don't get to make a plan. Because this is a movie, a heist of expediency.
Yes.
Nothing is ever, we never get the plan montage. We don't even get a plan, really. It's just right. Kind of like, okay, let's go. Number three, find out what the non-Skywalker side of the rebellion looks like.
Which is why I love this movie.
Right. And finally, I'm going to make it a simpler plan and only two words. Are you ready?
Sure.
Rebel scum.
There you go. There you go.
Because this is the kind of the dirty dozen of Star Wars. So there. Why did you choose this film?
Well, as I talked about in our intermission, I wanted something to contrast against Ocean's 11. Like, mm-hmm. if that movie is the pinnacle of heist films, which we both agree it is, it's
yes.
full of glitz and glamour, that I wanted something so separate, so different that it barely even compares. So Rogue One is dirty. It's desperate. There's a lot more on the line than a multi-million dollar payout. And it does have elements of a traditional heist movie, which is meaningful to our discussion of heist films. Mm-hmm. And I would wager as important to our discussion of heist films as something like A Perfect Specimen, like Ocean's 11.
Right.
So really it is to contrast, if that is the pinnacle, then what else is being done in the genre?
Yeah, yeah. And as we get into it, there's going to be very specific tropes that are found in many heist films that are
yes.
in this. I think I could make an argument against this being a heist film.
I could too.
In some ways. I mean, let alone the fact that you referred to each one of those three heists as missions rather
as missions.
Than heists. But it does have so many of the traditional heist aspects in it. You know, when we start talking about our heisto in our intermission, which will be available to anybody who wants one, I can get it off of our Facebook page. There's quite a few of them that can be applied to this film.
Yes.
So, yeah. When did you watch it for the first time?
Are you kidding me? It is Star Wars. I saw it in the theater opening weekend.
Yeah. Same.
And then it was a couple of years before I watched it again. And I distinctly remember watching it again on a home video and going, damn, this is just a really good movie. And
yeah.
I'll tell you what, I don't think I'd watched it since then until I watched it for this. And that was my exact same thought, is, man, this is such a really well-done movie.
Yeah, so this watch was my fourth time watching it. I definitely went and saw it opening weekend. I know this is a science fiction film that my wife actually enjoys, so
nice.
I watched it again with her. I don't remember if she came with me the first time or if as soon as it came out on, not streaming, but it came out on disc, we probably watched it. But then after we watched the very exceptional Andor show, we immediately went, well, we have to watch Rogue One now, and it makes this film even better.
It does.
And then, of course, I watch it for this one, so yeah.
Well, and when I watched it for this, I did introduce it both to my girlfriend and my son. And my son had been resistant about watching this movie. He had refused to watch this movie because he knew the characters don't make it out alive. And he didn't want to watch a two-hour film where he got to care about the characters and then they died. And we got about 60% of the way through the movie and he says from his chair, "Man, I'm really liking these characters now." So, sorry, Zane.
Yeah. Listen, you and I are not the only ones who liked it. Looking at Rotten Tomatoes, it has a tomato meter of 84% with close to 500 reviews.
Yep.
That's pretty good. An audience score of 87% with over 100,000, which makes sense. I mean, Star Wars fans are a vile bunch of scum, but they're also a very vocal and enthusiastic bunch of vile scum. I mean, like, might be one of the most toxic fandoms out there.
You're stealing my thunder, Drew.
But
yeah,
they clearly liked it. In fact, this has a higher rating than Ocean's 11.
Really? Yeah, you're right. It does.
Across the board. Yeah. I mean, not by a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, Ocean's 11, it has a little bit more nuance to it.
Yes.
As far as general audiences are concerned. I think, you know, you put Star Wars in front of it and people will go see it or watch it at home regardless. And we have proven time and time again with the many offerings of Disney Plus.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And I would argue that I enjoy many of them, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, when we look at a film, we look at the good, the bad, and the ugly of a film. These are the highlights, the bad bits, and worse bits, something not always generally in the film, but kind of surrounding the film. Maybe the thunder I was stealing from you. Rafe, what is something
you know
good?
Me so well.
I do. I do, and that's why this is such a fun thing to do. What is something good about Rogue One, A Star Wars Story? Also, can I stop saying A Star Wars Story?
No, that's okay. Required. That's okay. That's the full title.
Should I also then say Rogue One, : A Star Wars Story?
The good about this is the fact that they did set it so separate from the Skywalker saga, to the point that Gareth Edwards made the joke that the name is actually a pun, because if you have all 7 Star Wars movies that have come out that are about Anakin Skywalker and the Skywalker saga, then this is the Rogue One, because it doesn't touch on those. I love that pun, personally. You know, the fact that we don't get lightsabers until the very end of the film and only by one character. The fact that we don't have any real references to the Millennium Falcon or Luke Skywalker or Han Solo or any of those things. We get some really cute passing moments, like Dr. Ivaz and Pondo Baba showing up just for a brief second, you know, and that's a nice nod, that's a treat to give the fans, but the fact that they created something that was completely disconnected from the other Star Wars movies and did it so successfully. This was supposed to be the beginning of a anthology series of movies that did exactly this, and it pulled it off brilliantly.
All right, good. My turn for a counter-argument. I want to include this in the good, because you mentioned the things that I think are both good and bad about this film. Rogue One, : A Star Wars Story, is a film of contradictions. I think what makes it so incredibly good is its removal from the Skywalker saga. Every time it expands the Star Wars universe, the movie excels far beyond what I was expecting. However, every time it reminds you of the Star Wars, the Skywalker saga, it takes me out of the story of Rogue One, because I don't find those particularly amusing. I might have the first time I saw it, but now that I have a better understanding of what I like or don't like about Star Wars in general, as an IP, I think it's actually to the film's detriment, because the Skywalker saga is such a different kind of film than this is. You know, Pondo Baba and Ezevan, when they show up, I'm like, wait a second, how did they make it off the planet to get to Tatooine? You know, like the next day.
Right.
Legitimately, like the next, I mean, I know that you're going faster than light travel, but like it's kind of a bummer. I don't need to see 3PO. I don't need to see the middle act Vader scene. I think
I love that, and
I can understand why people like it. When we get to the battle, kind of a talk about that one. But I still think the best bits are the ones that kind of completely put us in a world that feels like it could have been in a role-playing game. And that's what I love about the Star Wars universe, because it's so much more than the one-liners. There's very little humor, and even the humor that exists, and that's mainly K2SO, comes with a kind of dourness to it that's sort of Marvin the Paranoid Android, sort of, and that really works for me.
Now, I have to ask, before we go any further, let me ask this, okay? Because you made the comment, you're not the world's biggest Star Wars fan, which
Correct. Is
absolutely fair. Have you seen Clone Wars or Rebels or Bad Batch, any of the animated stuff?
Yes, yeah, so I was given a list of movies, episodes recommended by my coworkers about Clone Wars, particularly to understand the Mandalorians a little bit better.
Right.
And to understand what was going to come up with the Bad Batch. I never got around to watching the Bad Batch, and I never watched, what was the middle one with all the characters who have shown up on Disney Plus fairly recently? Clone Wars, Bad Batch, and Rebels. I haven't seen Rebels. Yeah. So, no, I've watched some, if not all.
Because Saw Gerrera, played here by Forrest Whitaker, comes from the animated stuff. Like, we meet him.
Oh, I have no idea.
Yeah, see? And we meet him, and that's the interesting thing to me, is that what we see, he shows up and he is part of the Rebels, but he has always been that extremist to the point where he's kind of a bad guy, even though he's one of the good guys for the Star Wars world. And I love the fact that they continue that on here. So I was just curious as to whether that was something that took you out as well.
No, I had no concept. So that's really cool. And yeah. I don't think it would have as much. It's the specifically the Skywalker stuff.
Okay, but that's fair.
Yeah. Let's talk about something else. I think the direction in this film is phenomenal.
Oh, yes.
I really think Gareth Edwards got an idea of what Star Wars was, which has got to be really hard, right? Because I think you and I both come into this with a conception of what Star Wars should be based off of our youth. I had a conversation with my little brothers this past weekend, and they still say that the prequels are their favorites because that's the one that they watched when they were kids. But
right.
the thing
right,
is,
right, right. Like, it's and not that's who they were targeted us. At. Yeah, they were targeted
yeah, right,
at.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, it's like Star Wars is very much what you watched it as a youth or what kind of thing right. that you like. But when you look at someone who went from an indie film that was pretty creative to a Godzilla film, which I, you know, watched it recently for make the second or third time, and I think my appreciation of that film is growing, particularly as I watch more Godzilla films.
The direction is good, the story is not, is still my take on that one.
Yeah, yeah, I think some characters are wasted, but
yes.
But I think you're absolutely right. But watching this one, you know, I'm watching it with kind of a screenwriter and a director's eye, and it's really well done. We get our characters in, you know, that you have to, if you didn't know about Star Wars, this is the only Star Wars movie that you watch, for the most part, I think you'd get a good idea of what's going on. So I think if you go into it as not as a kind of diehard fan or a fan like myself, it's still a good movie, and it's a good Star Wars movie. And that peaks volumes because we've had a whole lot of really bad Star Wars movies, which are also bad movies. Also, good movies that are bad Star Wars movies. You know, like, it's a tightrope that you have to walk.
Let me take counterpoint to you. Oh, wait, except for I don't think you're going far enough. You've got to remember, up to this point, there had been 7 Star Wars movies. 5 of those Star Wars movies were directed by George Lucas.
Okay? Yeah.
He directed the first and the last in the original trilogy. Lawrence Kasdan directed the middle one. He directed all of the prequels. And J.J. Abrams takes over for the 7th film. Mm-hmm. So what you are seeing with this movie is not only not the Skywalker stuff, but it is then disconnected in a way that nothing else in Star Wars ever has been. And mm-hmm. I know you're praising him. I'm saying you're not praising him enough. The what he achieved with this film is so amazing.
I am going to just correct you. 4 of the original trilogies were directed by Lucas. Richard Marquand did Return of the Jedi.
Did he? I thought it was Lucas again. Okay, I stand corrected.
Everything that I've read and listened to about Lucas was, at that point in time, he had wanted nothing to do with directing. He really wanted to produce, write the story ideas, and he passed it off to other people. He wanted to work on other projects.
Okay, I stand corrected.
And I agree with you 100% in that it is really difficult. So I think he did a really good job. And
my other good that I'm going to throw in there, K2SO may be my second or third favorite of all of the droids of Star Wars ever, period. Like, he is so brilliantly done by Alan Tudyk. It's not even funny. I love the comic relief, but also you get some drama there at the end, and he's a great character.
Great character. Where does Gonk the Power Droid fall into your scale? I'm assuming it's number one or two then, right?
Yeah, a little lower than that. It's Chopper from Rebels, and then probably L3 from Solo, A Star Wars Story, and then K2SO.
I don't want to start on Solo. All right, so back to the good. This movie made me want to immediately watch A New Hope.
Exactly.
Like, every time I watch this film, I want to just go, all right, time for A New Hope.
Yep.
And that's really impressive.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say good about it?
Everything is good about it, except for what we start talking about in The Bad and the Ugly. But I love this movie. It's so well done. I mean, Donnie Yen and Wen Jiang is just amazing dynamic between the two of them. Of course, that comes from them working together before this film. But just what Donnie Yen brings to his character. And he apparently came up with the idea that Chirrut was blind. Like,
get out.
What I'm reading. Like, I knew he had influence on the character, but I didn't realize it went to that extent. And his performance is so soulful and beautiful, but not a Jedi. It doesn't have to be a Jedi in order to be that kind of character, and I love it.
Yeah, yeah. In the old West End Star Wars game, Chaotic Jedi.
Yeah, love it.
Let's talk about the bad. You know, I have already mentioned a couple of things, and I stick to my guns on that one. But are there some things that you seem to be really a big fan of this? So I'm going to let you go first. Things that you maybe disliked about the film.
Yeah, we shouldn't have done the CG faces for Tarkin and especially for Leia. And I know that they got the family's approval to do those characters, but the technology was not in the right place, and it definitely breaks the scene for me. There is still that very uncanny valley sensation in your brain when you are watching, especially Tarkin, so prominent in some of the scenes, that it's like, yeah, you could have just gone with an actor and we would have believed that it's the same character. And, you know, we don't believe for a second that Ewan McGregor is Alec Guinness. We could have taken a separate actor playing the part and just gone, okay, that's who's playing him now.
Yeah. Well, people age poorly in the Star Wars universe when you look at Alec Guinness and then Ewan McGregor. Like, that's only 18 years. That's rough.
Hey, Tatooine is a hard life, man.
It is a hard life. I agree with you. I had that in my ugly. I think they still could have used it very well if we only saw his face. We get a lot of reflection shots with Tarkin, and I think we probably could have pulled that off rather than a lot of the just blaring right in your face kind of a thing.
It's the second that they try to have them talk. That was my Tron Legacy did the exact same thing, and you had the young version of Flynn, and he turns the camera and it's like, oh, that's a little bit of CG, and then he talked. It was like, okay, you've totally broken the scene, and I kind of felt that here too.
I think in the same way that Lucas went back and kind of played around with the original trilogy. It's a shame that he did, but I think that we are going to see Disney Plus and Disney go back and increase the quality of those in the future. I think it seems very likely. Not going to throw any more money at it.
I doubt it because they don't want to do any more Star Wars stories like this. I mean, that's like the idea of it is broken. Why would you go back and throw more money at it?
I'm going to give you one. Sure. So like, again, I mentioned Pondo Baba and Dr. Evazan. I think James Earl Jones's voice feels old and stretched, and not nearly as powerful. It didn't work for me.
Okay.
I don't like the boar gullet scene. And I don't understand why it's there. From a script and narrative perspective, I understand that we get to see that Saw Gerrera is an extremist,
right,
and is so paranoid. You don't need the boar gullet to show that. Forrest Whitaker is acting just is amazing in this part. You can see the paranoia in his eyes. You can hear it in his voice. But the other thing is, he says the boar gullet's going to drive you mad. And there's this brief moment where Bodhi's character is mildly forgetful and then snaps up. There's no long-term issue with that scene. And it just seems like, I get it. It's a cool idea, but it's horrific in a way that maybe it's prepping people for the horrors to come, but it didn't work for me at any time in any of the four times I've watched this film.
Sure. No, I totally agree with that. I can get behind that.
But that's the end of my bad.
Mine too.
Yeah. All right. Ugly. Rafe, what is Imperial armor even good for?
That's just Dude, that's part of Star Wars. You just have to buy into that. That is not an ugly element of the story.
They punch a guy in the helmet and he goes unconscious. That's not how helmets work. And now, admittedly, Donnie Yen punches a guy. I understand that they go down.
K2SO like, takes them and smashes them together like Zebarelius in Rebels. And yeah, sure enough, it's like their armor's useless. That's okay. Not ugly. That's just part of the universe.
Okay. The complete lack of OSHA regulations in Star Wars still upsets me. There should be safety rails. I know it's a joke, but it's just like every time you see it, it's like this is just a lawsuit waiting to happen. And then the last thing, it's just a minor point, but the video game aperture in the storage tower that closes and she has to time it just right to go into it feels like it's like this is going to show up in the Rogue One video game.
Right.
And it's just like dumb. Just dumb.
Yeah.
Completely unnecessary.
Totally get behind that.
But honestly, considering if you and I were doing any other Star Wars movie, probably even including the original trilogy, that's very few bad and uglies.
Yeah.
It's a really good film.
My ugly, I alluded to earlier, you know, and you know, you wouldn't think it. This film has, again, 84% positive rating, 87% audience score. But the fandom surrounding Star Wars, especially in the last 10 years, but especially since this came out, has become so toxic and vitriolic. It's not even entertaining anymore. It's like, I think you hit it a minute ago that Star Wars is what we experience as a youth. Like, you and I experienced the original trilogy. That's what we think Star Wars is. So when the prequels came out, we were like, this isn't Star Wars. But then the generation that we're introduced to Star Wars through those movies love it. And the fact that a movie, an empire, forgive the word, that preaches, you know, kind of tolerance and understanding can have such a horrid fan base that just poo-poos on everything. The fact that this was the first of what was supposed to be a line of these kinds of Star Wars stories, and it dies with Solo, which is not that boisterously bad of a movie. It's not great, but we're not talking about it today. But the fact that there is such toxicity response to the more recent trilogy, that it's just ridiculous that why can't we just let people like what they like? Why can't we just, you know, if it's not for us, it's not for us. We don't have to destroy the world because it doesn't match what Star Wars is to us. What Star Wars is to me is not the same as what Star Wars is to you. It's obviously not the same as what Star Wars was to George Lucas. Just let it be, man. It's all good. Yeah. I am one with the Force. The Force is with me.
I think now is an interesting time. This is not going to be the last time we discuss this, but I think now is the time to introduce the idea of the Hays Code.
I love that you put this on here because, again, just having come off of the Hitchcock movies, and this played a prominent part in how Hitchcock had to shape some of his movies, and he loved kind of giving it the middle finger, proverbially.
Exactly right, yeah. And this film does the exact same thing. So for those who don't know, the Hays Code was in effect from 1934 to 1968, and it kind of determined what could be shown in cinema. Now, if you were an independent filmmaker, you could make your own independent film that didn't have to go with the Hays Code, but you couldn't show it in authorized cinemas. And,
right.
And the way that the Hollywood and the film industry worked is that if you weren't applying to the Hays Code, you might as well just forget it. Now, this doesn't apply to foreign films, right? So foreign films, there's all these amazing films that are being made at this time that don't pay any attention to this. But one of the things, and this is the most important thing to discuss when we're talking about heist films, is that criminal behavior cannot be rewarded.
Right.
In a Hays Code film, justice had to be meted out in one form or another. Either that the criminals don't get away with it, or the criminals have to be killed, or they're arrested. Most of the time it's killed. And in at least one of the films that we are going to talk about in the future, we'll probably go into a little bit more detail about it. But what I love about this film is that, you know, we've already alluded to the total party kill, right? Everyone is wiped out in this. And in many ways, that is the Hays Code in effect. It's being a mirrored for that time period because it is a heist film and all of our quote-unquote criminals, justice has been meted out.
One person's criminal is another person's rebel. It's all about perspective.
Exactly right. Now, technically, they win,
right?
Like, they succeed in their heist.
But they sacrifice themselves to get there.
Yeah. Right. So I think that's just something that we'll definitely explore more in the future.
Yeah.
But what we want to explore now is looking at the individual characters. We've already talked about every single one of them in one form or another. So what we've got here is, this is the section called Our Usual Suspects, where we're going to list the characters, but then apply to them the roles that we have discussed in our very first episode, where we discuss kind of every single role that we typically find, the tropes that we find in heist films. Now, Rafe and I have done this separately. He's got his list. I've got my list. I've seen his list. He hasn't seen mine. So, Rafe, what I think we should probably maybe do is go by character rather than list all of yours.
Sure.
List your character, explain like what you think their role is, and then why, and I'll do the same for the character after you.
Sure. All right. So we start with Jyn Erso, played by Felicity Jones. I had a hard time with this one because this is our audience surrogate, right? I mean, this is correct. Who we're following. She is kind of the partner in crime. She is kind of the right hand to Cassian Andor. But at the same time, she's kind of a new kid. And at the same time, she's just kind of a burglar. We know that she has experience with Rebel Alliance from before, but she has been gone from them for at least 5 years now, which is why she's incarcerated at the beginning of the film. So I had a little bit of trouble with her. I think mostly I'm going to focus on the idea that she is, you know, Cassian's right hand, that she's the partner in crime.
Good. I completely disagree with you. you look at the poster. Hers is the biggest face in there. I think you could look at her as the Lancer, which is someone who they have the same goals, but they're going about a different way. But for me, she's the leader of the group. I think the moment she becomes a part of the team, her influence changes everything. Cassian starts to ignore orders. She's the one that kind of brings the people together. She's the inspiration for it. And you're right. She is relatively new to that group, but we know that Saw Gerrera had her working in a while. So she's not... she's not the new kid. She's new to that group.
Right.
So really for me, well, I don't think anyone really is officially the leader of this team. It kind of feels like an ensemble in a way. I go with the Lancer and inspiration, but she's also muscle.
She is.
We get some really good scenes of her, and I think she's a fixer because she is a person who knows people, particularly Saw Gerrera. And she's a second story character, meaning that she's sort of our amazing yen in this one because we get the specific scene where she's good at climbing stuff. She climbs a lot of stuff in this film.
That's true.
That's where I'm going with it. So how about the next one?
All right. Cassian Andor, played by Diego Luna. And we're kind of supposed to think of him as the mastermind because he is the one that kind of comes up with the plan, except for, as you pointed out, there never at any point is really a plan laid out. He right. tells, like, when they get on to Scarif and he tells the men to go cause a distraction, he doesn't tell them what to do. He tells them make 10 men feel like 1,000.
Yeah.
So I put him down as the mastermind, but the truth is he's not really a mastermind. He is muscle. He is kind of a fixer as well, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
he's one of two characters that I really had trouble categorizing. We'll get to the second one here in a second.
I think, you know, if you're going to make an argument for anybody being the mastermind, I think it's going to be Jyn only because she starts in prison at the beginning of the story. Like if that's the way the tropes Fair. Are telling you who they are, considering that now the only two films that we talked about heist-wise both have are kind of a mastermind. He is an intelligence officer, right? So that's what he was, True. Or at least he says he is. We're ignoring Andor.
We see that right. in Andor.
Yeah.
Towards the
That's
end
what I'm saying,
it.
But like this came out before Andor, right. So like we have to go with what this is showing us. He is a strategist, and he's quite good at quite a lot of things. Again, he's sort of a Lancer in that situation, second in command, co-captain, I think, really yeah. works. But you're right. This is hard because the two of them are the leaders of the group, and they are coming at it from different right. directions, and they're both taking... They also have different motivations, which we'll talk about more when we start talking about the actual role-playing aspect of it. All right, next one.
All right, K2SO, played by Alan Tudyk, he was the easy one. He's the muscle, and he's the tech. He's the hacker.
Agreed, but he's also the pilot, because he's yeah. very specifically the one who flies the ship up until we get Bodhi, but
that's true. And even after we've got Bodhi, some.
Yeah. So like he's definitely a pilot / co-pilot, also the hacker, muscle, you know, he's
Jack of all trades.
Yeah, exactly. Like he's sort of, like, no one really slots in perfectly with the exception of Bodhi in this one.
Yeah.
But who's your next one?
All right. Chirrut Imwe, played by Donnie Yen. And I have no freaking clue what role to give him because he is, you know, a spiritual leader, which doesn't really fit into a heist. He is not a con man. He believes what he is preaching absolutely. And it pays off for him in the long run. But I could not figure out a role to give him.
So as far as heist crew goes, no role. But we talk about adding tags, right? So tag isn't necessarily a heist. So you can have a pickpocket who is also the new kid, right? So we're looking at Linus. So that the new kid part is the tag rather than the role. And yeah, so he's the conscience of the group. And like many World War II films, the conscious guy is usually the one who goes mad and gets killed first. But it's not necessarily the case. But yeah, it's an interesting character. Slots into the where we would have had a Jedi, and to the film's benefit, doesn't.
Right.
Next.
All right. Baze Malbus, played by Wen Yang. He is munitions. He is the heavy gunner. He is Chirrut's right-hand man. But, you know, I mean, he is the only one that really fits into the, what he does is carry a big gun and blow things up.
Right. He carries a big gun. Yeah. He speaks softly and carries a big stick. Exactly. I have muscle and firepower. Yeah. Next.
Bodhi Rook, played by Riz Ahmed. He is our wheelman. He is a pilot. That's what he's supposed to be good at, even though he doesn't get to do it. And I got to add in Star Wars Galaxy of Heroes, the mobile Star Wars game, he is a character in the game, but doesn't have a ship still.
Oh, no.
Never That's given horrible. That character a ship.
He's clearly the pilot. He says, "I'm the pilot." It's like 50 times in the
right.
film. That's a little bit of the Borgullet influence. But he's also, I believe, is the newbie. He's he's the youth.
Well, because he's just now defecting over. That makes
correct.
Sense. Yeah.
Right. So, like, and in many ways, Galen Erso becomes the kind of the mentor to him. What we get, rather than having a full crew, is we've got a lot of double acts. There's a lot of pairings that go in, which is interesting, too, because K2SO gets replaced with Jyn Erso as the double act with Cassian.
Sure.
For the latter half of that one. Also, in a way, Bodhi is the inside man. We don't get a reveal, but like he's the one who kind of starts off in that way and then flips. I mean, clearly Galen Erso is the inside man as well and plays that part a little bit more so. But in a sense, that's not too far off.
Sergeant Melshi, minor character, but he is definitely the fixer. He's played by Duncan Powell. He is the one that, like they say, you know, go create a distraction or we need to get this cable hooked up. He's the one on the other end of the radio. Mm-hmm. He's the one who has to fix the problems that they send his way.
I don't have anything. I just agree with you on this one. I went with the folks who are on the poster for the most part.
All right. Well, then real quick, the other three that I had, Saw Gerrera, played by Forrest Whitaker, is a mastermind. He's just an opposing mastermind because he's not even with the Rebel Alliance, even though he's a rebel cell. Director Orson Krennic, played by Ben Mendelsohn, is the mark, or as close to a mark as they're going to get, because they're not actually taking from him. They're taking it from the Empire. And then Galen Erso, Mads Mikkelsen, that would be the inside man in my mind, because he's the one who has leaked the plans.
Yeah. So with Krennic, he's the mark, but he's also the competition for the second and third act, and Saw Gerrera is the competition for the first act.
Yeah,
like him and his crew are actively like kind of the antagonists. In addition to, there's a lot of people. There's a lot of factions. There's a lot of ins and outs and what have you.
It doesn't cleanly fit into the heist milieu that we're talking about. But that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
But I still, as I said when I introduced it, it is a non-traditional heist film. It is a heist film that is something, it is a Star Wars movie that then takes on elements of a heist film.
Right. And what I like about this is it's far enough away from being a heist film that everything else we're going to talk about is probably going to fall in between the two of them.
Yeah.
Like I think it's about as far as we can get from the classic heist film while still being one. Every other example that I've got on my lists, I think you can associate it a little closer to kind of that kind of golden mean of what a heist movie is. So, you know, agreed. It works really well. Do we want to talk about playbooks? We talked about playbooks with the last one, but, you know, Ocean's 11 had specific con names.
Right. And the one thing I do want to throw in there, just because it was on TV Tropes for this, is that there is a Bavarian fire drill, which is something that was referenced when we talked about Oceans. And technically, TV Tropes has it listed as having a Bavarian fire, one of them. I argue that there's two.
Because
it's a tactic which you get what you want by acting as if you already have the authority to do it. And I would argue that Bodhi does that when he gives the initial name Rogue One, when he comes up with their clearance to leave the Rebel base. That is a Bavarian fire drill, and then later on when he's diverting stormtroopers away from the Citadel, that's the one that TV Tropes gives. And I loved that, the fact that it is given that same name as it was in Oceans.
I think that's perfectly fine. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, looking at what you've got, there's a Jim Brown, there's a Miss Daisy, there's a Black Bag Job. All of those are kind of similar to the ones, you know, to what we've got. It's a heist film.
Yeah.
We don't have to go for complications. I don't think there's a lot going on. I think the main kind of complications that we have is that in the first act, Cassian and Jin are at opposing mm-hmm. kind of missions. And then the Death Star keeps on showing up and blowing up everything. Like, you know, like, could you imagine?
It has a tendency to get people on the same page real quick.
Right? It's just like, you're either with us or against us. Well, Rafe, we have come to the portion where it is time to rate this film. Now, for those who are just joining us for the very first time, we rate our films on a double axis, meaning we're going to rate it how good of a movie it is out of 10, right? So 10 being the best, 1 being the worst. But we're also going to then rate it as a heist film in comparison to other films within the genre. So how would you rate Rogue One, : A Star Wars Story, as a film out of 10?
This is one of my absolute favorite ones. I'm giving it a 9 out of 10. I think as far as the Star Wars movies goes, this is one that I enjoy watching as much as the original Star Wars, which, you know, we all know as A New Hope now, that I just love to revisit. And I love the fact that it then makes me want to revisit A New Hope. So I'm giving it a 9 out of 10.
I'm giving it an 8 out of 10. I think it's an exceptionally good film. I think it's very different. I mean, it's clearly different from the ones. It is Star Wars for adults. Like, I can get that kids would like this, but I don't think young kids are going to appreciate this in the same way that that we do. It is a war film. It is a rebellion film. And it really feeds into the, this is why we fight. This is not a fantasy film, right? Like, this is not wish fulfillment. You don't want to be any of these characters, like, essentially, because the bad things happen to them. This is a gritty film.
Yeah.
And I like that.
I do too.
And if I rate a film 8 to 10, it's a good film, and I would recommend it to anyone.
All right. How good of a heist film do you think it is?
Are you asking me? You want me to go first?
I absolutely want you to go first on this.
I'm going
to
give it a 6 out of 10.
Me too.
Okay, fantastic.
We're on the same page. I wanted a non-traditional heist film. There were definitely parts of watching it where I was going, this could be heistier. But ultimately, I think it still accomplishes what I want. And I think if you go back and look at our ratings, our scorings for the first season, we didn't really score any Kids on Bikes movies lower than a 6 on the Kids on Bikes scale.
Agreed. This is definitely a heist film. It's just... Like we've said multiple times. And there are moments where I'm like, oh, this is a military film, this is a war film. And I'm like, nope, that trope is in there.
Right.
Nope, that falls into our three things that we really want out of it. It's a really good second pick. It's like the more, as I was watching it and kind of writing my notes going, this is really good. I like this. So I don't think I need to defend giving it a 6 if you're giving it. So I'm not going to give it my negatives or positives about the film. So... heist philosophy. What is a line from the film that sums up the heist? Rafe, I have the benefit of seeing what you have selected on here.
Yes.
I will say that mine is not on your list.
Oh, interesting. All right. Well, yeah. my number one was rebellions are built on hope. And that line is repeated. It is something that is said early on in the film. And then Jyn Erso picks up for later in the film. And of course, it leads into what, you know, what is that? It's hope. And then we have A New Hope. And I love that. But I think as far as summing up the heist itself, Jyn Erso has a line where she says, they have no idea we're coming. They have no reason to expect us. If we can make it to the ground, we'll take the next chance and the next, on and on until we win or the chances are spent. And I think that line sums up the philosophy behind their heist completely. There is no planning. It is, we take this chance and, oh, we got away with that. Now on to the next chance. Oh, we're dead. You know, I mean, I think that summarizes the movie perfectly.
Yeah, I think that is a much better summation of the plan, the actual heist itself, rather than the reasoning behind it. Agreed. It works really well. There's another one on here. Do you want to? You've already mentioned it, but you want
to? I just happen to love Cassian's line about make 10 men feel like 100. The passion with which he gives that line, because that's also imperative to their plan, is they don't have the bodies. They don't have the support that they think. They don't know that the rebels are going to end up giving them support. So right. I love that. That just kind of showcases the desperation behind that houses their philosophy.
And it's a con. It is a con with a
That's
very
a great
specific
point.
It is like, we need to make them think that there's more of us.
Right.
That that works really, really well. Mine is, as I said, different, and it's actually not something that is said by any of our heroes. It is actually said by our enemy. And what I feel sums up this film is, when has become now. And that is a line that Tarkin says to Krennic.
Yeah.
And I think it's basically like, we do not have time to plan. We have to go. Right. When has become now. And I think that's, as soon as I heard that line, I was like, oh, that's it.
I like that a lot.
We are going to draft some characters, but first we need to draft a song for our steal a song portion. For those who haven't listened to the last episodes, this is Rafe's idea. It's a great idea. When you have a film like Ocean's 11, where you've got an amazing, just upbeat soundtrack, each one of us is going to be drafting a song from the film, putting it on a playlist on Spotify, and then making it available.
This was a bad pick for the steal a song. Like, I came up with the steal a song idea and then immediately undermined it with my first pick, where I was like, oh, there's no songs. There's the score.
There's scores.
So, but I have a track from the score. I hope you have a track from the score.
I do. And so we should mention, because this is a thing that we frequently don't do, is mention who actually wrote it. So this is Michael Giacchino,
who
is, I think we've mentioned it on a, because he also scored Super 8. He's one of those composers who I just didn't realize was creeping into my life as much as his work has.
Yep.
In particular, his work for the new Star Trek films.
Yep.
It's one of those things where it's on my favorite list and will come up. I don't think I've ever skipped past a Giacchino score. So the downside to these, they're all really good. The downside for most of them for me is if they're really long.
Yeah.
I feel like it kind of changes it. And personally for me, anything that reminds me too much of Star Wars and makes it feel too specific to this movie. Which is one of the reasons I didn't take Elvis's Littlest Conversation.
Right.
In the last one, it feels it's very much Ocean's 11. That being said, Rafe, what have you selected for your Telsha's 12?
I started this soundtrack with a somber tune, and I know we can end up rearranging the order of these to make a better mixtape when we're done, but I'm going to stay kind of on that somber note, which means next movie I really need to be able to punch it into high gear. But I'm going with the Guardians of the Will's suit. You know, this is the music that I didn't talk about that in the good. One of the things I absolutely love is Lucas's early draft of Star Wars was a Star Wars story about the Guardians of the Wills. And so the idea that we brought the Guardians the Wills into this. They're referenced only in the Star Wars movies in The Last Jedi, I believe. But I love this piece of music. It is a somber piece of music. It goes very well with Chirrut's character.
Yeah, agreed. This was definitely on my short list of ones to select. I did not select it.
Oh, nice. I thought you would have, so good.
So I looked at the three shortest pieces. I mean, I listened to the entire soundtrack many times fairly recently, but I looked at the three shortest pieces that I felt would fit in. But one of the things that I really wanted to consider, one is not do anything that was too recognizable as being part of Star Wars.
Sure.
But also, you know, my team, or both of our teams, were criminals.
Yes.
We should have a criminal song. We should have something that feels
Smooth
bad.
Smooth Criminal is not on this list.
Smooth Criminal is not on here, and neither is the Imperial March.
And neither is Swinging on a Star from Hudson Hawk.
It's true. So what I actually went with is the same thing of my theory of with the heist philosophy. When has become now, and
okay.
And it's a good one.
Although that does have a piece of John Williams' music in it.
It does, and so and
but
that's
it's not
the reason.
Distinctly recognizable.
It's true. But it is an imperial. It is very much we're the bad guys. And I think one of those things where it has a kind of a really good flourish that feels like we've stumbled on something. It's got some low menacing bits that kind of swells towards the end. It's only 2 minutes long. And I think it works. It has a kind of criminal feel to it. And I think that works. I think you could sample that one piece two or three times in a film and make it work. Pretty
fantastic.
Good.
I like it.
You like it. I like it. And everyone likes the next segment.
Yeah, all right. It is time for our draft. This is a reminder that over the course of this season, we will be building a team of one mastermind and seven specialists. But before then, we will end up having 12 characters each that we have to cull down to that, much like we did the first season with our kids on bikes. This time, I picked the movie, which means Drew gets to draft his character first.
Yeah.
Disadvantage of picking the film. I want to know what you are planning on doing with your heist crew of a cranky old man and a big imperial robot.
Well, here's the thing. If you're going to have Saul Bloom. A cranky old Jewish man. Then you gotta pair it with K2SO.
Like, I knew it. The second you said, when I announced this movie, you said, I'm going to tell you my draft pick right now. I was like, he is taking K2SO.
I had three. No, I... Really? Listen, no, K2SO was definitely first and foremost. But I had two other potentials, and I want to talk about them leading into it. But you, of course, it's K2SO. And mainly because it's that pairing. Like, if nothing else, I am going to... It has already dictated that I'm probably going to have a very humorous team moving forward. But my second pick, my potential, was Chirrut. I think if you offer me Donnie Yen, how can you not take Donnie Yen? And I think the only way you don't take Donnie Yen is if Alan Tudyk is a you know, a kind of a somber robot. But the other one is Jyn Erso, and mainly because I think she's an interesting character. She's got a lot going on. I think she would slot well into a number of teams. But also there's just, you know, this is an interesting genre of film. There's not a lot of good female representation in heist films. And I know that one or two of the movies I'm going to pick are definitely going to be ones that focus on that aspect of it, because the motivations are a lot different in a lot of the films. But ultimately, I had to go with... like, because like the two of them next to each other. Right, what are you gonna do? You know, I was gonna list the ones that potentially, because, you know, I think Weetief Siabu, Warwick Davis's weird little kind of critter like character with a gun.
I love how you included him in the list, but not the weird cyborg guy who actually puts the bags over their head to take them to Saw Gerrera.
But he doesn't show up in the second half of the film. I think he gets blowed up, doesn't he?
Yeah, I would assume so.
Yeah, I think for me, the Scarif is the heist. There's two missions, but Scarif is it feels like the proper heist itself. Yes. And I mainly included characters who were in that. But who are you picking?
I'm really torn on this, because there's a part
of
me...
You knew you weren't going to get K2SO,
right? Oh, I knew, yeah. Oh, yeah. As I said, the second you said, can I go ahead and tell you who my draft pick was, I was like, okay, he's off the table. There's no way I'm going to get him. There's a part of me that really wants to make this a lighthearted team. You know, I've got Basher, who is definitely sarcastic and such, and I can picture pairing him with, like, Jyn or Cassian, and them kind of being trying to outquip each other type thing. Right. And then I start off with kind of a silly team. But, you know, my Goonies team started off with Mikey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I started with the heart, and I don't have that with Basher. And I think I do want a team with a conscience. Uh-huh. So I think I have to go with Chirrut, Imwe. As you said a minute ago, if you give me the chance to take Donnie Yen, how can I pass that up? Well, I don't have Alan Tudyk as a robot to pick on, so I'm going with Chirrut, Imwe.
Right, yeah, and like the moment I was watching this film going, like, he could surprise me. You have surprised me in the past with your picks, and I'm not saying, you know, like, it's good, but, like, you can't pass that up.
No, it's the Rafe pick. It's definitely...
Donnie Yen and... And Don Cheadle, you have the two Dons at this point in time. You've got two Dons on your team.
My only nightmare in picking Chirrut is I couldn't figure out how to classify him in our usual suspects. So statting him, you know, figuring out what archetype he would be, that's going to be a pain for the. But yeah. that's an intermission problem. That's
but
a later
currently
problem.
He's your muscle,
right? That's true.
You know, your muscle with a conscience is always a really interesting character.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Oh, boy. All right. Well, in a brief moment, we are going to jump into the RPG portion of that, and we'll do that right after this break.
My name is Johnny, and I'm the host, executive producer, and Prince of Lies for the Monsters Playbook. What's the Monsters Playbook? It's an actual play Monster of the Week podcast set in my hometown of Minneapolis, Minnesota, where no monster can hurt you as badly as you can hurt yourself. It's a character-focused adventure where you'll meet Kira Ashwood, a journalist with a cult past she's desperate to atone for, and a secret power hidden even from herself. Casey Davis, a taciturn secret agent becoming disillusioned with the agency she thought she could trust. Theo Nessos, a professional sorceress trying to escape the shadow of her powerful magical family. And Mark Clayton, a pretty haunted introvert who just wants to make sense of his powers and all the weird things that keep happening to him. This is a show where danger could just as easily come from an otherworldly threat as from the fragile emotions that anchor our characters and bind them together. If you like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The Dresden Files, or any city-set supernatural story with monstrous threats and messy feelings, check out The Monsters Playbook. New episodes every other Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. It is time now to discuss how we can gamify Rogue One, a Star Wars story, so that anyone can play a role-playing game session inspired by the movie. Not a carbon copy of the movie, but inspired by the movie. And this is done regardless of the system you're using, the way we go about it. So we're going to start with our session zero, with the discussions you need to have with your players before you begin playing. So Drew, what kind of discussions do you want to bring to the table for our session zero?
I mean, the number one thing I think needs to be discussed when we are doing a game inspired is, I think we have to just flat out and say everyone's going to die.
Yes.
Right? Like, it's not that that's the main takeaway of Rogue One.
No.
Colon, a Star Wars story. But it's such a memorable part of it.
Right.
And it's not something that we usually do in role-playing games. It really puts the emphasis on role-playing rather than the game part of it, right? Like, a lot of the times we're trying to survive, trying to beat the problems. So rather, it's not like, how do we avoid death, but how do we make our death meaningful?
Right.
And I think we just have to have everyone agree that this is a game that we're going to play in which our characters will be dead at the end of it. This is not going to be a game. This is not going to be a campaign.
Right.
Or if it is, this is the end of it.
Right. Or the prequel, and you're going to have different characters.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and that's true. And I've done that on a number of occasions where we have characters pass away, and then the next story takes place in the future, and those characters and their sacrifice or whatever are being turned into references to inform the next players, which is fun.
Sure.
What do you think? What's next on a session zero?
I think because role-playing is going to become such an important aspect in a game inspired by this movie, it goes back to one of the quotes I picked for summarizing the heist, which is rebellions are built on hope. So I think you challenge each player to determine what gives their character hope. Is it something in their lives already that helps keep them going? Is it something that they are hoping to achieve in the future? What is their hope that they are holding on to?
Right. So that's what keeps them going when things turn dark. Conversely, I would add that each player should consider for their character something that they have to have had happen to them in their past that makes them willing to sacrifice their life for that hope. Right? What is that shadow of that hope? In this, what has the Empire done to you to make you willing to put yourself at risk?
Sure.
This is heavy stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, it's not going to be a lighthearted game.
No, it's not.
And we'll get into game systems in a couple minutes. I mean, if you want to play it on paranoia, then yes, it's going to be more lighthearted.
Paranoia, spoilers, is not a system that I am going to be suggesting when we get to that.
All right. So what we also look at in order to get to the heart of the story, as we said, this is not supposed to be like a play-by-play recreation at your table. This is supposed to follow the spirit. And the way we get to that is looking at the truth. So if you follow these truths, if you hold to these truths at the gaming table, the game should feel like the movie, regardless of what system you're playing. So, Drew, I'm going to start us off with what I felt like was the most important truth to this kind of story, which is the enemy is overwhelming and undefeatable. It is not an army of goblins that you have the chance of knocking down. It is vast and something you just cannot overcome.
Yeah, you are background characters in the history. You're not even a footnote in the in the story of the war, right? None of you are Skywalkers. Right. None of you are going to be the ones that are going to deal the killing blow. You might win the battle, but you are not going to win the war in this game. And that's a really tough thing, because most of the time when we play these games, our characters, especially, this is the experience I've been having, I'm really trying to emphasize with my kids, when I say my kids, the teenagers that I work with, is that they're the heroes of the story. They should play like they're the heroes of the story. Whereas this, they are still the heroes, but they are not going to be the ones that no one's going to be building statues to these folks.
Right. They're not going to be remembered. Yeah. What they accomplish is important.
Yeah.
But there's not going to be any songs sung about them.
Right. And that kind of leads us into what should be the next truth, which is their sacrifices should be meaningful. Now, there's a way to gamify this, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But, you know, like, everyone should come at this understanding that they win if their sacrifice is awesome.
Right.
It doesn't have to be how many you take out with you. It's like, yeah, so.
I think another truth to keep in mind, I particularly liked this, we have the point in the movie where they're going to find Galen Erso, and Jin is trying to rescue him, and Cassian is sent to assassinate him. And they're not communicating that, but I think it's absolutely okay for you to play a game where not everybody has the same goals, where players' characters have separate goals, and the other players may not be aware of those goals, or they may be, you know, you never know.
Yeah, and that's something that as a game master, you could very easily help gamify that by assigning goals to characters and not allowing the other players to know what they are until the scene takes place. Yeah, and that, again, makes it very much something that we see with Rogue One. Yeah, so, and this is something that I feel like you and I are going to say every single episode, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's because it's important. Just like any kind of game, you have to have a hero moment for your players that shows that the creation of their character, however hard they worked on it, has to be able to show off the talent that their character has. Every member of the crew has to have a scene where they use their speciality at some point in time within the heist, the adventure.
Right. Which we said for Ocean's 11, we're saying it here. I think you're right. We'd probably be saying that one for most movies in this genre.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, allow for the crew to make up for shortcomings in creative ways. Like we see this in the movie again, you know, Bodhi has to get the communications thing connected. He is not the tech. He is the pilot. And yet we see him, you know, finding a way to make it happen. You know, allow them, especially if you go with a smaller crew like this movie has, you know, they're not going to have every role filled. And I think we kind of covered that when we were looking at where are they in the crew? Well, they're everywhere. You know, they're not just one specific archetype in that crew.
I'm going to add one more because something you just sparked an idea. We refer to them as being a crew, right? Like six main characters. But like when we start looking at Scarif, they are a small crew within a kind of fairly decent sized army. But we don't really care about the other characters.
Right.
So like I think that is something, if you're looking at the truth, you still could potentially do that. I think the crew should have access to a resource that is like backup, right?
Sure.
But it shouldn't be taken for granted. They have to work to convince that backup to exist.
Oh, I'm like going to get, I have that in the mechanics.
Okay, cool, I have a different approach
to it in the mechanics though. Okay. And feel free to chime in when we hit that, but yeah.
All right, well, let's go into the mechanics. I think we've got our session zero, we got our truce. Let's go into the mechanics, things that these are, you know, we look at things as an agnostic rules. So it doesn't matter what system you're playing. Any of these can be added to kind of bring focus to the truths that we're going to have in this kind of game.
Sure. Go ahead and start.
Fate. So we talked about knowing that our characters are going to die. With fate, this can be used any system, but the players have to decide how they want their characters to die. And I think if you want to gamify it, I would say using like a single adjective, you know, like heroically or ironically, or with a vague action description, like I want my character to die saving others. I want my character to die in a blaze of glory. And that allows us to essentially play scenes towards that end. Because while winning the game means getting the heist done, finding the MacGuffin, stopping the whatever, you also win if your character can die that way. But it's really important that this is not plot armor.
Right.
It doesn't mean that if your character, like, I want my character to die in a blaze of glory, but you fell down a manhole and you're going to slowly starve to death. Like, that can still happen.
Sure.
If you roll poorly or you make odd decisions. So it's not something that your fate is not determined. It's what you're aiming towards. This is I actually created a game, like a one-page game about dying, specifically trying to play the game to the GM rather than your typical game where the GM's trying to kill you and your players are trying to survive, the GM is trying to keep you alive and the players are trying to die in the way that they're supposed to. Like, if they announce ahead of time how they want to perish and the GM is attempting to save them on every occurrence to keep them from that. And I like this idea because I think it works really well because it allows us to strategize our failings in a way.
Well, and my first one kind of ties into that same idea and helps with that plot armor idea. And mine is hope. And the idea that given, you know, you have an overwhelming opponent, the adventure is going to be fast-paced. You know,
yes.
These guys don't get to stop and strategize. They have to make it up as they go along, which means there's not a lot of chance to rest up and heal. There's not going to be any short rests or long rests going on here. You know, so, but we want their death to be meaningful. If they fall down those that manhole, you know, that's not meaningful. It can happen. The rolls can suck. So to help them survive just a little bit longer, give them the opportunity to call upon hope to get them through a potential death or catastrophic failure. If you have good role players, this is the chance for them to create a brief scene where they remember exactly what they're fighting for, and then give them the opportunity to either make a hope roll or give them hope tokens at the beginning of the game that they can burn for this, and that allows them to kind of, so they fall down that manhole and they're dying and they remember little Tommy that they've left at home and they have to make the universe a better place for him, and by God, even though they have a broken leg, they get up and they keep moving, you know?
Do you know what scene immediately comes to mind when you're describing this? It's not a scene from a movie. It's a scene from a comic book. This is a classic where Spider-Man, Peter Parker, in his suit, has all of this heavy, heavy metal on top of him.
Mm-hmm.
And the room is filling up with water. And he's like remembering Mary Jane, remembering Aunt May, remembering, he lifts it up. And it's like this amazing heroic moment. Yeah, I love it. I love it.
Which they borrowed from for Tom Holland's Spider-Man Homecoming. Yeah.
Of course they do. Of course they did.
All right. You know, we've talked about clocks before. This is my alternative on a ticking clock, which kind of goes to something Drew was saying a minute ago. So obviously there's going to be a ticking clock of some sort, but instead of giving a ticking clock for the enemy, which is what we normally do, the enemy's guaranteed to win. Remember? They're unbeatable. They're going to win. So put a clock into play for the cavalry. Players what the clock is. Just put the clock where they can see it. It's counting down. Let them worry about, does that mean that's the point that we fail? And when the clock runs out, the cavalry arrives. They have that support that helps distract the enemy and allow them to finish with a bang.
Right. So you have a backup along with that where if they do X, Y, and Z, the clock moves forward a couple of extra clicks. If they're actively trying to convince the clock to move forward. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. I love it.
Yeah.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Last thing, I have one more.
I love this one, by the way. This goes so much with what we were putting before. I love it.
Yeah. So that's the idea of sacrifice as a mechanic. So not just your fate, but sacrifice. And a player can sacrifice their character in order to achieve a required quest or narrative goal. No role is required when a sacrifice is made. So you're going to succeed in the role. You don't even have the role. You're going to succeed in that action, but your character's done. You're done. You can sit back and you can just watch the rest of the game take place. And that's the exchange. You succeed, but at a cost. Alternatively, a character can sacrifice themselves if another character would be killed before they've achieved their fate. So you can, like, if someone's like, my fate is to die taking out the person who destroyed my family or did this, you know, like that's a part. And but they roll real poorly. They're out of hope tokens. All of this, like everything, you can basically sacrifice yourself. Explain how that works, allowing them to continue forward. But again, that means you're out. Like you sit back and you have to listen. But this is where role playing, like sometimes listening to everyone else describe is just as enjoyable. I wouldn't recommend doing it in the first 10 minutes of the game, but there you go. Whew, there's a lot of games that this works. You know, it's one of those things where I've yet to find a perfect space fantasy game. And you don't have to do this as a space fantasy game. There's a lot of games out there where, you know, this could easily be a D&D game. This could easily be a Call of Cthulhu game, actually, if you think about it. I mean, everyone should die at the end of a Call of Cthulhu game.
I was
game
waiting
to begin
for you to
with.
Say it. I've been, like, we have done so many different Kids on Bikes ones where you're like, oh, you could do this in the Star Wars universe. I was like, I'm waiting for him to say that this can finally be done in the Star. No, he's going to say Call of Cthulhu. And sure enough, you never disappoint me, Drew.
Clearly, there's a lot of Star Wars role-playing games that you can play this in. Personally, I haven't played the newest editions, so my preference is always going to be for the old D6 system from West End Games.
Seconded.
I really like it. Everyday Heroes, it works. I mean, here's the thing. There's a lot of guns in this game, in this film, and blasters play a huge part in it. Teens in Space can work as well. Scum and Villainy is specifically, it's Blades in the Dark, but it's in space. It's if you ever wanted to be a crew of smugglers, this is probably the perfect game, slowly building your way up through that kind of environment. But really almost anything that you can play that will allow you to do that using the four extra mechanics that we kind of described. I don't see any reason why you couldn't do this. I think the only kind of game that doesn't work is if a game that is supposed to be upbeat and fun where everyone lives, you know, by its very nature, that doesn't work. But other than that, I think you've got a lot ahead of you.
Yeah. All right. It is time for question four. Drew.
Drew. Yeah.
We just finished talking about how the kind of at the heart of this game, there is going to be a total party kill. And that's just a truth of this.
Yes.
Have you ever approached playing with a group with that same mentality where you're just like, yes, I'm going to kill them? Have you ever been the bad GM, Drew?
No.
Never?
I've wanted to demolish my players' characters. And it's possible that maybe really early on being a DM or GM, maybe in my 20s, but shortly after I kind of moved away from home, there was this gap where I wasn't playing. You keep in mind that there's a time where, like, I was embarrassed to tell people that I played role-playing games because it wasn't popular and it was really hard to find a group. You know, this pre-internet where you couldn't find like-minded individuals. And reaching out to people and asking them to play and getting them to say yes, the thing that you don't want to do is immediately then destroy their characters because they won't want to play with you again. So it's never really been a thing that I wanted to do. And then shortly after I kind of moved away from home and started role-playing again, we started playing a game called Legend of the Five Rings, which is one of these games where the role-playing was so much more important than the combat because the combat was like single rolls and your character's dead. You know, if this is a fantasy samurai game, but like most of our players were courtiers and like dinner with a high-ranking official is far more deadly than fighting a bunch of ninjas. Like you have a chance of surviving ninjas. If you roll poorly and you insult a courtier, you're dead, your family's dead, you have to commit seppuku. And you don't want that story to end. You work so hard to come up with these ideas. So yeah, for me, unless the game was very specifically based around, like, I want your characters to die so that then they are continuing the game in the afterlife, which I think I've done at least once or twice before, or like I mentioned, having characters die and then the players knew that was going to happen because those characters were in the past. I think I did something along those lines, but I've never actively tried to destroy a group of players against their will.
Fair. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, Drew, as we close things up, our next episode will be our intermission. Do you want to remind everyone of podcast homework before we sign off?
Yeah. So with our podcast homework, Rafe and I are both going to answer this question. And that question is, in Ocean's 11, the crew has to break into a high-tech secured location within a popular tourist destination surrounded by people. What popular location, either real life or fictional, do you think would make a good, fun, or challenging spot to hold an RPG or even a heist movie? So this could be either as a GM running the game or as a player playing the game. So we're going to answer that next time, but we also would like you to answer that.
Yes.
Find us on our Facebook page and answer that question for us, because I'm really kind of curious, because I'm sure there's locations I haven't even thought of yet that, you know, heists are kind of the thing now. It's what I'm thinking about most. I'm trying to come up with more heists for the role-playing games that I'm running. So, you know, your suggestions may just give me that spark that I need to create just the perfect game. And there will be a new podcast homework on our next episode as well. We'll answer this one and then I'll give you some new stuff. Probably, and I haven't come up with it yet, but it'll probably be more Rogue One: A Star Wars Story inspired. So I think that should be the way to do it. So yeah, join us in several weeks for our Rogue One intermission, where we will discuss our second opinions of the film, anything we might have missed, stat our draft picks, which should prove very interesting. We'll go over any kind of listener emails or responses that we've gotten on our social media. If you have opinions, like we've said, of your own, if you want to join us in our discussion, you can find us on a number of places. You can email us at theneversaydiepodcast@gmail.com. You can head over to our Facebook group. It's called the Never Say Diecast. And you can find us on X at Never Say Diecast.
If you like to hear our other projects, if you love our voices and just want to hear what we have to say about other things, if you like Doctor Who, Drew can be found monthly on the Who and Company podcast, as well as the Doctor Who podcast. And you can find me on Have Not Seen This podcast, assuming I start getting some new episodes up. But there's like 90 episodes there for you to listen to.
Yeah. I mean, additionally, if you want to see what kind of movies that we've been watching, spoilers, it's a lot of Godzilla for me. You can follow us on Letterboxd. My handle is Boy Howdy. And so that is the letter B, the number zero, the letter Y, and then Howdy, as you want to play it, all one word.
And I'm simpler. I am Talon Hess, TalnHess. If you have a moment, please rate and review the podcast. A rating of 5 stars helps others find the show and join in the conversation. And if you actually write a review, it makes Drew's ego feel really good.
Just absolutely strokes that ego in a way that you would not believe.
Thanks to Chris Talent for our rebellious theme song and Megan Daly for our awesome show artwork.
And remember, even if your entire squad falls down a manhole, there's still hope. So never say die.